From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a special conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ronan Farrow. We talk about his new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence.
The broader restoration of the culture and prestige and the flow of talent into diplomacy is a harder problem. And we have to start fixing it now. And even then, it's going to take a generation, I think, to get where it needs to be.
We also talk about the challenges he faced while reporting his blockbuster story on Harvey Weinstein's history of sexual assault.
You know, everyone that I called in a moment of crisis, which was every day was a moment of crisis because I was being, you know, staked out and followed by these former Mossad agents and I was losing my job and I everything was falling apart.
A special conversation with Ronan Farrow coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, wishing you a safe and happy Memorial Day. Today, we're going to listen to a special hour of conversation with Ronan Farrow. In October 2017, Farrow in the New Yorker magazine and Megan Twohey and Jody Cantor in the New York Times broke the story of Harvey Weinstein's long history of sexual harassment and predatory, retaliatory behavior. The stories revitalized the Me Too movement, which quickly turned into a worldwide reckoning about the sexual abuse of women. Farrow, along with Twohey and Cantor, won the Pulitzer Prize for their reporting. And last Friday, Weinstein turned himself in to the New York Police Department and was charged with multiple counts of sexual assault. Well, at the same time Farrow was investigating Weinstein, he also had another huge project in the works, a sweeping exploration of the decline of American diplomacy. He interviewed every living Secretary of State, spoke with concerned whistleblowers in the State Department, and turned the work into the book War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. Earlier this month, I had a fascinating conversation with Ronan Farrow about his book and about the Weinstein story. We spoke before a live audience at Harvard's Memorial Church, and this hour, we're going to listen to that conversation.
Good evening. So it's an incredible pleasure to be here, to have been invited to converse with you, Ronan, about American diplomacy. But I do also want to personally congratulate you on your Pulitzer Prize.
Thank you.
I am dazed and relieved, and there were a lot of obstacles to that story. So I'm just so grateful to all the sources who did a brave thing, and very glad I was able to get the story out in the end.
In a little bit, we'll just talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about what's happening in Washington and then the consequences of that around the world. I mean, when you just set the stage for us, I mean, there's policy-wise, there's a palpable sense, obviously, of the change in America's diplomatic posture. But even I've been told by some former diplomats that when you walk around the halls of the State Department itself, it's eerily quiet.
It's very eerie. It's very strange going back. I went back to hang out with Rex Tillerson a little bit. That was fun. There's a lot of empty offices there. It's weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, unfortunately, that's more than just an aesthetic change. That is a fundamental reflection of a real shift in America's posture in the world. We just don't have negotiators and peacemakers anymore. And in hotspot after hotspot, we don't have an ambassador in charge. Mm-hmm. We don't have an assistant secretary of state in charge of that region.
I mean, even just to the point of appointees, I was looking at the Washington Post has a database where they track appointees in the Trump administration that require congressional approval. So those are top-level political folks, but even in that, just that regard, as of today, there are 61 positions in the State Department that have no nominee at all. 61 positions. Chief Financial Officer, Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy and Human Rights, etc. Ambassadors for almost 30 countries.
30 countries we just don't have ambassadors in.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the effects of that are not trivial. These are places where very often we have pressing priorities that directly relate to the safety of Americans abroad and to our interests in crucial parts of the world, and you need the imprimatur of an actual person in the job.
Yeah. But even more importantly, I mean, the nominees and the appointees get a lot of attention by virtue of their titles, but what you're talking about here in the book is the gutting of the career civil servants in the State Department. In the opening of the book, you talk about the Mahogany Massacre.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So Mahogany Row is the fancy schmancy wing of the State Department on the 7th floor, where the Secretary of State's office is and the diplomatic receiving rooms are, and it's where a lot of the kind of most elite Foreign Service officers get the plum positions. And a few weeks into the Trump administration, there was a moment where basically there was a purge across the department, and even including these elite roles that a lot of the people in them thought were untouchable. And unceremoniously, one after another, these people got the boot. And there were offices across that hallway that day and across the broader State Department that, you know, called together their staff and said, everybody's fired. You're all removed from your posts.
Who led that?
So there's a lot of passing the buck about this now. And so War on Peace is bookended by the story of Tom Countryman, who was our senior official on arms control. It turns out a pretty important area of concern that maybe we would want a senior official in that job, but he got the boot within a few days of Trump coming in, even before the broader Mahogany Row massacre. And, you know, I tell his story and how he was in the middle of an important mission, and he just suddenly got the call saying, you know, you're out. And I asked Rex Tillerson about Tom Countryman, and he said, I'm not familiar with that one.
Huh. That was part of his mission as Secretary of State, was to trim down the State Department.
Yeah, so there's a combination of, you know, he passed the buck and said, that was the White House, I had nothing to do with that. But then also in a broader sense, he did preside over these deep, deep cuts in a pretty ardent way. He really embraced these cuts and defended them on the Hill, and he's as candid as I've ever seen him in this book. It's one of his last interviews before he was fired, and he does say, I pushed back against those cuts in private. I regret championing them. He doesn't use the word regret, but he says, you know, maybe I was just inexperienced and I didn't know better.
How can the CEO of ExxonMobil, though, be inexperienced in championing for the business units that he needs to have, needs to support? I mean, did you buy that when he said that?
I mean, it's the question to ask. It's a real mystery. The guy has this peerless track record of private sector leadership, but for whatever reason, through a combination of him taking the job, knowing that he was acquiescing to this goal of cutting the department down, or simply him not realizing that being the head of a government agency requires a lot more combative advocacy than he maybe was used to. You know, I can't speculate as to why he was so out of his depth, but he was.
Interesting. So, I mean, you know this quote very well because some of the most vocal support for not cutting the State Department's budget actually came from the Defense Department, right? It was in February 2017 that Secretary Mattis said, if you don't fund the State Department fully, then I need to buy more ammunition, ultimately. So I think it's a cost-benefit ratio. The more that we put into the State Department's diplomacy, hopefully the less we'll have to put into the military budget as we deal with the outcome of an apparent American withdrawal from the international scene.
One of the great ironies is that we have left our diplomacy so leaderless that often the great pleas for diplomatic capacity come from the Pentagon. You know, I think savvy military leaders understand that the balance of power within our government and even within the executive branch is really important.
I mean, it's that soft power, hard power balance.
You need both.
Yeah.
You really do. And
but
we don't have both going right now.
I mean, we'll come back to the specifics of what's happening with the Trump administration in a second, but I feel like this tendency or the trend towards using the harder edge of American power or having the sharp end of American diplomacy be preeminent has been going on for some time, though.
So invariably the headlines about this go, you know, unprecedented battle against the State Department, you know, the Trump administration laying siege to the State Department. We've never seen anything like it. And I think those headlines are half true. you know, this is a new extreme, and it is unlike anything we've quite seen before. But that's not to say that there's no precedent. I talk about the Clinton administration as an example of that, where after the Cold War, there was understandably this political pressure to kind of turn inward, and James Carville, his campaign manager, said, you know, it's the economy, stupid, was going to be the mantra. And indeed, when they got in, he dispatched his first Secretary of State, the late Warren Christopher, to go to the Hill and sound a whole lot like Rex Tillerson. You know, he got up there and he said, we're going to downsize and we can do this leaner and more efficiently and we don't need all these people. And over the course of the 90s, we cut our diplomacy and development spending by 30%. You know, not unlike you see now, there were all these colorful anecdotes of, like, you know, diplomats in Beijing desperately jerry-rigging a barbecue to the roof to try to, you know, get TV signals because they didn't have a budget for TVs. You know, the sewer's leaking and they have in a major embassy and they don't know what to do about it. This banal stuff that just exemplified how little we cared about the profession at that point. And it had really long-term ramifications because not only did we cede important footholds of American influence, we also shuttered and folded back into the State Department proper, you know, really downsizing their expertise and influence to government agencies, one devoted to arms control, obviously important now, and the other devoted to information, which we could also use in the propaganda war against ISIS.
Yeah.
And so those, you know, devoted bodies of experts were largely gone. And when 9/11 came around, we just didn't have the capacity we needed on the diplomatic side. So this becomes a vicious cycle. You know, when there's a moment of crisis and we need a balanced approach where we have experts and people steeped in a region to steer the military intervention and embedded in a long-term strategy, we just don't have that. So we do more and more through the Pentagon, rinse, repeat.
But it does seem as if now that lack is being compounded by an active hostility against expertise, against diplomatic expertise.
Yes, on multiple levels. I mean, first of all, the purge that I talked about and these mass firings and the unwillingness to fill the roles that are left standing. Secondly, in terms of the voices that are in the room. You know, I talk about, during Richard Holbrooke's final days in the Obama administration, his frustration at not being able to get a meeting with the president, and that being emblematic of a broader declining space for diplomatic voices. As you point out, it is exponentially worse now. This is a White House more full than ever with former generals. So you wind up in Afghanistan with us, you know, doubling down again. You wind up in places like Yemen with a new set of rules that just allows the Pentagon to set their own troop levels and call a lot of shots that were once the domain of a collaborative conversation with the State Department and the White House. This is really military power unbridled in a way that we haven't seen before in the policy process.
You know, I've had one of my favorite guests that we have on our show is Admiral James DeVries. He's the dean at the Tufts.
He's fantastic.
Yeah, he's
yeah.
awesome.
And he's in War on Peace.
and so I think I ask him the same set of questions every time. I don't know why, but I do. And I said, you know, if we're having this withdrawal of American leadership on the global stage, are we leaving behind a vacuum? And he immediately tells me no. Because it's China, for example.
Yes.
That's absolutely willing to step in.
I love that all these people are saying things that reinforce the thesis of my one.
But there are consequences to that, right? I mean,
for sure, yeah. You know, I've been getting a surprising number of questions, you know, from people who are sort of skeptical of this premise, saying, you know, well, is it so bad, really, if the United States surrenders leadership? Like, why do we have to be the leader? That question often comes in the context of, like, look at Germany. Why can't she deal with the leadership stuff? You know, give it to Angela Merkel. But we're not looking at Angela Merkel leading the free world. We are looking at Beijing filling all these spaces that we're leaving empty. And I talk a lot in the book about how that is a shadow that's cast over this whole narrative of American diplomatic decline. Diplomacy, as much as any other single area, is a great lens through which to view China's ascent, because for years, they really hewed very closely to this stereotype we have in American foreign policy of what China is in the world. You know, this rapacious interloper that doesn't give a damn about human rights and, you know, gets in, gets the oil out, and leaves, you know, and if they aid and abet a genocide in the process, who cares? You know, that was their position in Sudan for years and years. And now things have changed. Now, just to continue with the Sudan example, you know, they've got a regional envoy there doing shuttle diplomacy of the kind Richard Holbrooke once did for the United States. And you know, trying to get a splashy political settlement there. The same is true in Afghanistan. They're trying to, you know, broker talks between the Pakistanis and the Afghans. You know, they are picking up our slack. And we have to take a long, hard look at ourselves and say, is that what we want for the world? Because as much as I don't paint an overly rosy picture of the United States leadership, and I'm frank about our own human rights problems and the way in which we can sometimes be a malign influence, I still sincerely believe that the world is a better place if American values prevail than if what Chinese values are at the moment prevail.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ronan Farrow speaking with me in a special live conversation at Harvard's Memorial Church earlier this month. There's a lot more coming up after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's get back to our special conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ronan Farrow. We spoke before a live audience earlier this month at Harvard's Memorial Church. Farrow had just published his new book, War on Peace: The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. We've been talking about how there has been a trend over multiple administrations that may just be peaking now in terms of some aspects of the diminishment of the State Department. That just makes me wonder, though, does it simply require a new administration to come in to completely reverse that trend? Or are there sort of deeper changes in terms of how America as a whole sees what it wants from its diplomatic service?
Well, we've seen a couple of times administrations that have this kind of hyper-militarized approach in key policy processes come to recognize that that's a disaster and then try to course correct. So that happened with the George W. Bush administration, where there were the devastations of Iraq, and Colin Powell was in there talking very frankly about how that came about and how entwined that was with the disempowerment of his State Department. And then in the second term of that administration, they did do a considerable amount of refocusing on diplomacy within Iraq, around the world. Condoleezza Rice launched these six-party talks on North Korea, which it's actually not quite right when people like President Trump or Shinzo Abe says this a lot, the Japanese leader, you know, that was a complete failure. That was a set of commitments from the North Koreans that ultimately fell through, but we also made some inroads there. We made significant inroads in our conversation with China about this. That's still going to be a conversation we have to pick up if we want a regional solution there from a diplomatic standpoint. They did make some initial headway in shutting down nuclear reactors that they had never shut down before. You know, there were some tangible inroads. You know, that's exactly the kind of expertise that we're throwing out now. So in a couple of cases, we have seen a course correction within a single administration. The same thing happened during the Obama administration, where senior officials under Obama are in this book saying, you know what? Yeah, we got snowed by celebrity generals for a while. And then look at the end of our time in office. You know, we spent a few years doubling down on the Iran deal and the thaw in relations with Cuba and the Paris Climate Change Accords. Again, all things that are under threat right now. But you see, if you spend a few good years just committing to diplomacy, it doesn't take long to see results. So while the current approach to diplomacy doesn't inspire a lot of confidence, theoretically, there's no reason why within a single administration, if there's a second Trump term, you know, that we couldn't see a reversal of course on this.
So you spoke to every living Secretary of State for this book, including Hillary Clinton.
Including Hillary Clinton.
Is it true that in the process of you getting to meet her, that you were reporting on the Weinstein story and her people wanted to cancel your conversations with her?
That is true, and I should note that her folks, the same people who made that call to me saying we found out that you're reporting on Weinstein and sounding very concerned about that, have, as I anticipated, followed up and said, you know, we completely dispute the idea that, you know, this cancellation was, or attempted cancellation was because of Weinstein. So I relate that faithfully. You know, unsurprisingly, she does not say that she tried to cancel this interview because of Weinstein. I'll just give you the simple facts and not speculate as to her state of mind beyond that, which is at a time when it has now been reported that she and her team had very close contacts with Weinstein, who was one of her biggest coordinators of Democratic donor money, they discovered that I was working on this story, and I got a call from one of her folks saying, you know, we hear you're working on a big, sensitive story, and, you know, to me, sounding alarmed about this. And then shortly thereafter, a long-scheduled interview went away and became impossible to schedule. And that was supposed to be, you know, a lengthy sit-down. I had reported to her for years. We had a close rapport. She clearly believed in the subject of this book and said so in numerous letters to me where she committed to that interview. And suddenly, you know, I became a nuclear thing to touch. And in the end, I have to express gratitude because, you know, I did come back to them, and after a whole lot of begging and pointing out that this would become a book in which every other living Secretary of State was on the record, and one had called me about Harvey Weinstein and then was unavailable, you know, they did reinstate a brief phone call, which was cut off hastily, but she did go on the record, and she didn't have to do that, and, you know, I do believe she cares profoundly about this, but I'll leave it to you to judge whether she had other countervailing concerns as well.
So, it's still never fails to amaze me that you were writing a book about American diplomacy and reporting on Harvey Weinstein at the same time. Do you sleep?
I did not sleep. Boy, that was a rough period, and I was a nightmare for everyone in my life. I mean, my poor mom and my partner and, you know, everyone that I called in a moment of crisis, which was every day was a moment of crisis because I was being, you know, staked out and followed by these former Mossad agents, and I was losing my job, and I, you know, everything was falling apart. And so there was not a lot of sleeping and not a lot of eating, and I was insufferable, and I'm very grateful to all of those people for putting up with me.
Yeah. There are so many themes here, and one of them is absolutely the damage that people in power, men in power, can do, let alone, you know, obviously to their immediate victims, as you reported in your New Yorker story on Harvey Weinstein, but and as well to, you know, some of the folks who seek to tell that truth to that power. I am curious, I want to just ask you a couple questions around the specifics of your Harvey Weinstein story, but if I get my numbers right, 10-month investigation, you talked to 300 people. Is that right?
I'd have to look back at the exact tally, which we did come up with, but yeah, it was a very large number of sources.
But then when you're close to finishing, NBC says they're not going to put it on the air.
It was...
Was that Harvey Weinstein? I mean, because stepping
It was a lot more involved than that, and I can't tell you that whole story right now. But, you know, I would say that people are not wrong to ask about that, and I would say in the broadest of terms, the question of, you know, media complicity and the decisions media outlets made around this story for many years are really germane to understanding what kept the veil of silence in place for so long.
Yeah. So over and over again, you have been unfailingly gracious in saying that the real credit should go to the women who were courageous enough to go on the record with you. And I just want to note that, because you're here, so I'm talking to you about your experience in reporting this, but you have been rightly saying that if your sources hadn't told you their stories in painful detail.
Painful detail. And, you know, that's not a feint, that's not false modesty, it's something I really feel deeply, and you would feel it too if you had these conversations with them. They really re-traumatize themselves and expose themselves to risk of terrible reprisal and retaliation. And they didn't have to do it. And they did it because they wanted to protect the next woman to come along, and they wanted to make the culture better around this. and it was hell for them, and there were a lot of ups and downs for so many of these sources. And so, you know, when you mention the kind of the commendations and the way this has been received, I really sincerely and humbly just feel so grateful to them and so relieved that, you know, I did my part to not let them down.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that they've inspired all these other people, you know, women and now men as well, to come forward and talk about this scourge of sexual violence.
Well, so tell me more about that. I mean, how has it felt, how does it feel to watch since just October of last year, your reporting and obviously the reporting from the New York Times as well, having been the sparks behind what's now a global movement?
It's an honor to have played a small role in that, you know, and I do feel very much like a conduit for, you know, the stories of other people. And I do think journalists can play a really important role in making those stories ironclad and interrogating them thoroughly. You know, my job here, I've pointed out often, was not as an activist and was not to, as some people say, I think, you know, with the best of intentions, to believe all women. It was to listen to all women and to listen to all survivors of sexual violence, because as a culture, we weren't doing that. And there were very powerful systems in place to prevent us from hearing those stories.
Yeah.
So, you know, to the extent that my work was meticulous enough to help chip away at that culture of silence and to expose some of those systems, I'm just really grateful to have been a part of that.
And if you don't mind me saying, you have said before in other interviews that, you know, you credit your own sister as well.
I do, yeah.
For showing you the importance of listening to victims.
People ask a lot, why now? And I think there are a number of answers to that question. But one is that the world had changed. And that's partly down to a gradual progression of brave survivors coming forward with allegations. So, you know, there was the set of allegations from Cosby's accusers. And
years, yeah.
I struggled to cover those and met with a fair amount of resistance. And there was a very different culture that they were met with. You know, even recently, yes, for years, you're right. But even when this bubbled up, 5 years ago, there was a lot of smearing of those women and impugning of their credibility. And they really went through hell. And they stuck to their guns. And I think that was inspiring for the sources in the Weinstein story to see. And, you know, then there were the women who began speaking out against the culture at Fox News. And I talked about all of those precedents a lot in my early conversations with Weinstein's accusers. I talked about Cosby's accusers. I talked about Gretchen Carlson,
yeah,
who deserves a tremendous amount of credit as a leader on that front. And, you know, all of those were small slivers of hope, but they allowed me to open a window into a world in which they might take all of this risk and go through all of this pain and be heard at the end.
New Yorker reporter Ronan Farrow speaking to me in a special live conversation at Harvard's Memorial Church earlier this month. We'll hear the last part of our talk after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Now for the final part of our special conversation with Ronan Farrow. He spoke before a live audience at Harvard's Memorial Church earlier this month. Farrow talked with me about the challenges he faced reporting his blockbuster story on Harvey Weinstein's years of sexual harassment. He also talked with me about his new book, War on Peace, about the decline of American diplomatic influence. And as I mentioned, we were in conversation before a live audience, so we ended our talk with some of their questions.
Well, you know, I've been monopolizing this conversation here, but we actually have a bunch of good, interesting questions from folks out there, and I'm trying to keep track of time.
I can tell this is a tough audience.
So, here we go. Sarah from Malden is asking, what have you found most difficult in your pursuit of this story?
Other than Hillary canceling. I say that somewhat facetiously, but I also it's not untrue that mostly it was a really positive experience trying to get people to speak for this, because I think with that one exception, just about every other Secretary of State was incredibly passionate about going on the record. You know, these are men and women to a one who believe in the enterprise of American diplomacy and are deeply concerned about the way in which it is being assaulted right now. And, you know, Colin Powell just about broke my heart with his candor about this, you know, saying we're ripping the guts out of the State Department and we're mortgaging our futures. And, you know, you talk to a guy like that and he's like he stepped out of another era. You know, he has such a sense of decorum and public service. And, yeah, his legacy is complicated and he's the first to admit it, but he's just such a compassionate human being and clearly cares so much for these diplomats getting the axe, who are in a workforce that he invested in deeply. There were logistical challenges other than the booking of these interviews. You know, General Dostum, the famous Uzbek warlord, is not a guy who gives a lot of interviews to journalists. So it was a year-long process getting him on the record, and, you know, as with Hillary Clinton, I'm really grateful that he decided to, in the end, talk to me, but it wasn't easy getting there. And, you know, that was a very colorful tract of the book, obviously, yeah. Where, you know, I go and kind of try to unravel the mystery of a mass grave in Afghanistan that we covered up for a long time, partly as a result of this more militarized culture that leads to, among other things, alliances with strongmen and warlords. And then, you know, at the end of that process, you're in the court of a warlord, and he's got guys with M4s on their chests behind him, and he's weirdly arrived to the interview with a reindeer. so that there's a lot going on there, and the antlers are sharp. and also, he was accused of killing a guy right after our interview. So, you know, my mom wasn't thrilled that I was running around to some of these places for the book. But in the end, you know, it was a really rewarding process and something of a labor of love. And I'm really grateful that you're taking the time to talk about it and everyone is here supporting it.
I mean, speaking of your mom, didn't she also recently say that for obvious reasons, she was really worried about you when you were reporting on Weinstein as well?
Yeah, she was. I mean, I think everyone around me was. I think it will become increasingly clear over the coming months and years as a variety of processes unfold, that not all of which I can talk about yet, you know, just how much the systems I described to you earlier mm-hmm. came crashing down on journalists chasing the story. And, you know, I was very grateful to emerge from that with the story intact and me intact.
As we are grateful as well. So Sandra from Newton asks, as the U.S. pivots from the Middle East to Asia, it allows the emergence of regional contenders like Saudi Arabia and Iran. How do you see that playing out, and how assertive do you think Russia will be in shaping or manipulating the region?
Whoa, that's a lot of questions in one. You know, one thing I talk about is how an additional ramification of this trend line of the deprofessionalizing of diplomacy opens us up to a skewing of our alliances and interests, and potentially to exploitation and influence from outside parties. So one thing my colleagues at The New Yorker, Evan Osnos and Adam Entus, have reported on is that Jared Kushner, you know, kicked all of the experts and diplomats out of the room when he met with the Chinese ambassador. And that's a thing that we don't usually allow for a variety of reasons, one of which is they can say whatever they want about what transpired in that meeting. The other of which is, you know, it sincerely does allow space for funny business to happen. And when you have intelligence agencies saying there is an influence campaign underway targeting Jared Kushner, you know, you don't necessarily want those deprofessionalized meetings. You know, that strips us of yet another layer of armor that professional diplomacy can provide. And, you know, I think there have been similar questions about, you know, Kushner's predilection for the Saudis and their crown prince and the way that has affected our engagement in the Middle East. And obviously very high-profile questions about the way in which that sort of less professional culture of secret meetings and an absence of diplomats in those meetings has informed the Russia collusion questions.
Mm-hmm. It does boggle the mind about the scale of damage that can be done in a short period of time, though.
It's pretty impressive.
Pretty
impressive.
About that, after doing all this work and speaking with all these people, do you retain any sense of optimism? I mean, I think we talked about this a little bit earlier, but optimism that that there will be light after the darkness on this?
Sincerely, yes. I wouldn't have written this book if I thought it was a eulogy for diplomacy. I don't think that would be super useful or fun to read. There's an unflinching portrait of the problem in War on Peace, but a good deal of the book is devoted to the solutions as well. And, you know, I cite that example of how the Obama administration really did meaningfully course correct, during the second term under John Kerry's leadership at the State Department, and how we wound up with a series of really significant diplomatic accomplishments, which, regardless of what you think of the Iran deal, it's a serious diplomatic undertaking. And, I think that that is one of several swaths of history that we can look to that can inspire hope.
Yeah.
That basically, if you put 3 or 4 years into actually having leadership that wants diplomatic accomplishment, you can see results pretty quickly. The broader restoration of the culture and prestige and the flow of talent into diplomacy is a harder problem. And we have to start fixing it now, and even then it's going to take a generation, I think, to get where it needs to be.
Aha. So on that point, it's as if we had planned it. Linda asks, what would you advise a young person at the beginning of their career to enter the Foreign Service right now? Or would you advise a young person to enter the Foreign Service now?
I actually would say yes to that. I mean, look, there are all of the pros and cons of a career in government service, and the pay is not great, and it means uprooting your family and moving around a lot, and there's a lot of sacrifice, but it's an incredible adventure. And, you know, I know a lot of my dear friends who are career Foreign Service officers and who have toughed it out through this period are really glad that they have, and, are sincerely invested in the important day-to-day work of diplomacy, even in this maelstrom, and we need more good people doing that. So I would say it's a rewarding line of work. It is an adventure and a way of seeing the world and maybe making it a better place. And we actually need people to make that decision.
And there are a lot of open spots now, I guess,
There's
too.
There's a ton of open
unfortunately.
Spots.
Unfortunately. Jeff is asking, Jeff from Cambridge says, of the so-called adults in the room, only Defense Secretary Mattis seems to have remained untarnished by his association with President Trump. Do you also see him as some sort of bulwark against war?
He certainly feels like a rare grown-up in the midst of all this chaos, and he certainly has advocated for robust diplomacy. And one of the complications of the narrative is you don't necessarily want to see a White House full of generals, and you don't necessarily want to see the leader of the Pentagon calling all the shots to the exclusion of counterbalancing voices. But in this case, I think a lot of commentators are correct from all the firsthand accounts I've heard of what's going on in that White House to be grateful for General Mattis and his presence. There's a very colorful tract from a source close to the White House, which, as you may all know, is a phrase that gets used a lot in reporting about this White House, and I'll leave it at that, talking about Mattis's approach to the president. And it's not entirely a flattering rendering. It's someone saying, when Mattis approaches the president, it's, oh, you're so perfect, Mr. President, and you won so much, and, we love you, Mr. President, you can do no wrong, but also here's this bit of perspective. That rendering was given to me in the context of talking about Rex Tillerson's failure to suck up in that way. Uh-huh. So, if indeed Mattis has cracked the code in terms of how to manage this president and his ego, probably we should all be grateful for that.
Hmm. Well, so Rex Tillerson is gone. H.R. McMaster is gone, too.
I mean, Rex Tillerson ain't dead. Rex Tillerson has gone back to several cattle ranches and something like $400 million and his wife, Renda, and, you know, I think we'll be okay.
but you know, when you, I was thinking about when you were talking about how Mattis approaches the president, with the departure of Tillerson and McMaster as well, we have replacements in those positions in John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, whom, for both men, the president has very vociferously said, what I like about them is they think the way I think.
Yeah.
So...
which is a really, you know, a classic kind of authoritarian tendency, you know, that this does not seem to be a president that welcomes a lot of dissenting voices within his administration. And indeed, although Rex Tillerson, you know, willingly presided over these cuts for a good deal of his tenure, he also pushed back against things like Trump's zeal to withdraw from the Iran deal. And clearly that did him no favors. You know, in the twilight of his tenure, Tillerson was doing a lot of messaging that was very supportive of the diplomatic corps and, you know, was trying to kind of shift the messaging. They hired a press guy, an undersecretary for public relations, who had been the Wall Street Journal's media guy. Steve Goldstein was his name. You know, he was in the job for 5 minutes at the end, and who was sort of, you know, a New York liberal and knew how to talk to the press. And there was all this... machinery just starting to rev up to reverse course on the anti-Foreign Service messaging that had settled over the department. And, you know, I can't speculate as to whether that was a part of what ultimately turned the president on Rex Tillerson, but it did seem like those things happened in close proximity, yeah. That there was dissent and then there was the axe.
So on that point, Susan from Dennisport says, do you think Mike Pompeo will continue the deconstruction of the State Department?
Susan, the president says Mike Pompeo is on his wavelength. The only wavelength we have, you know, reliably read out of this president with respect to the State Department so far seems to be like a death ray wavelength. you know, what we know about Pompeo is that he's a dyed-in-the-wool hawk. You know, he doesn't seem like a guy who really endorses a whole lot of non-military approaches. He seems very displeased with the diplomacy around the Iran deal.
Adamantly opposed to it.
Adamantly. And, you know, it'll be an interesting ride seeing how he performs in that job. But there's a lot of hope resting with Mike Pompeo right now. I don't think anyone is wanting him to fail in this job. He is certainly a much more consummate and experienced navigator of the D.C. political scene. You know, the guy is a politician, and maybe that will serve him well, and he'll avoid some of the pitfalls of his predecessor. I certainly hope so.
Yeah. Deborah from Cambridge asks, I'm grateful for your role as a public advocate for all survivors.
Thank you, Deborah.
You've commented, though, that the Weinstein piece was assigned to you. Do you feel an expose on a predator by a woman would have been taken as seriously?
Well, I mean, clearly, yes, because there were many women in the group of reporters who, you know, did incredible work on sexual assault and harassment over the past year. You know, someone like Emily Steele at the Times has, I think, absolutely and correctly been regarded with the utmost seriousness. You know, in this case, this wasn't like, you know, someone descended from on high and said, we will task you with cracking this story, Ronan Farrow, over any women in the room. You know, this was a case where I was doggedly demanding to cover this issue of sexual harassment and assault. You know, as is often the case when you're in a large corporate structure and you're doing stories that kind of create a headache for the lawyers, you know, there was a fight over how far I could go and what I could do. And there was, you know, for a time, a green light I retained on looking at the topic. And then obviously once... you know, it became about Weinstein, a lot changed very fast. But the piece of it that I think you're referring to where I have said, you know, I didn't come in with some vendetta against Weinstein, you know, this was actually a suggestion that came about naturally, you know, in conversations with my chain of command there, was there was indeed an idle remark of like, oh, you should talk to, you know, this actress. Seems like she was tweeting about this one guy. So I do think it's fair to say that that was an assignment of sorts.
Yeah. And that actress was Rose McGowan, right?
Yeah, Rose McGowan, you know, to this day I point out to people who have expressed, you know, a lot of criticism of her that, you know, she did earnestly try to sound the alarm about this and reach out to reporters about it at a time when she didn't have to.
I love this next question. Julia from Boston is asking, if you could go back and talk to yourself as a young journalist, which, by the way, are you... You're 30.
I know.
Now?
That is brutal. That's hard to hear.
He's still very, very, very.
No, she's right.
Experienced.
I can see the changes.
Accomplished, but young.
I can't stay up all night anymore. I have one glass of wine, and it's I'm hungover in the morning.
The blonde is covering up all the gray, right, Ronan?
It truly is.
But Julia's asking if you could go back and talk to yourself as a young journalist, just starting out. What advice would you give your past self?
I'm puffier in places I didn't used to be. I'm sorry, the question is what advice I would give myself? what advice would I give myself? I don't know. I'm pretty grateful for the way things have turned out. And, one of the lessons I think that many people stumble into over time is life isn't about trying to get it all right all the time. You know, I've failed. I've failed really publicly. I'm under attack all the time in this job. A lot of it is ridiculous stuff that doesn't stick, but, it's a range of, it's smearing in the press, it's physical intimidation, it's all sorts of stuff that, feels like a weight on my shoulders. And, you just have to embrace the fact that none of this looks perfect. And, you try your best, and there are ups and downs and low points, and it's all sort of part, not to sound super like new age about it, but it's part of the rhythm of how it unfolds. I don't think I would necessarily give up the lessons that I gained from the failures. I'm sure there are a lot of more granular pieces of advice that I could give myself, like, get more sleep and start answering the emails before it gets to 40,000 unanswered emails. there's all these people that I've mentioned in this conversation that I just haven't responded to their email in the last 3 weeks, and I feel really bad now. And I'm thinking about it, Adam Antus sent me such a nice, Ivan Osno sent me a nice note. There's probably a lot of schooling myself I could have done about, time management and efficiency. And there's been a constant tension. I gave a commencement speech when I was, 20 or something, the same age as the graduating class. And in my effort to be less annoying, I kind of did a mea culpa of I do not know what I'm doing, and that's okay. And my whole thesis at that point was, the Renaissance man can be a wonderful asset to our culture. And yes, we need the hyper-specialized person, but also for all of you who, like me, don't know what you want to do or can't settle on the one thing, maybe that's okay too. And I still don't know whether that was right. I think maybe you can do two things at once, but you kind of max out after that. Yeah. I've definitely felt my own limitations a lot. So there's your rambling answer to that.
Well, I have to say, if all that you've done so far comes along with you feeling your own limitations, then I cannot wait to see what more you have in store in the coming years, decades.
And thank you, Magna.
What is absolutely going to be a phenomenal career, because it already has been. Ronan Farrow, this has been a true privilege. Congratulations.
Real
and
pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody. I'm so grateful that you came out here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ronan Farrow. He's author of the new book, War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence. And of course, he reported the stories in The New Yorker about Harvey Weinstein that sparked the global Me Too movement. Last Friday, Weinstein turned himself in and was officially charged with multiple counts of sexual assault. Farrow and I spoke before a live audience at Harvard's Memorial Church earlier this month. And by the way, when I said I couldn't wait to see what Farrow would be working on next? Well, just 5 days after this conversation, Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer published another blockbuster story in The New Yorker, this one about then-New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman and chilling accusations against him of a history of sexual and physical abuse of women. Schneiderman resigned 3 hours after The New Yorker published its story. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston, with help from Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. Special thanks today to Harvard's Memorial Church staff, the Harvard Bookstore, and Tony DiBartolo for providing us with today's recording. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.